You'll never get more enjoyment out of disagreeing with someone about politics. You'll like it even better when you agree with him. Dan Carlin, Common Sense.
If you really want to make changes to the American system, you know, you have something that you want to do that's going to fix everything or fix the biggest problems, or, you know, how many things do we talk about on this program as being necessary reforms, things that, you know, we in the United States, but, you know, maybe even globally, you could talk about reforms that need to be made, corrections, catch-ups, holes patched, new avenues for doing things open. I mean, the bigger the problems get and the longer we go without solving them, the more we kick the can down the road on the tough decisions. We've talked about all these things many times on the program. The bigger the problems get, the bigger the solutions get, and the harder it is to imagine them actually ever being enacted, right? We can hardly get small things sometimes enacted in this country. The idea of any kind of like transformative reform big enough to help us steer away from the iceberg is hard to imagine in our system. But if you were going to do it, you win the presidency, you say you're going to do A, B, and C, and you know it's tough. Where's the decision point? I mean, where do you have to really win to get what you want in this system? I think of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt sometimes because he's a singular example. When you look at U.S. presidents, we've never had one before since like that, if only because of the time the guy served in office. For those of you who don't know, we've only had one president win four terms, you know, in office, and nobody else has ever had more than two. The rule used to be sort of unwritten. Washington only served two. Nobody had any rule about how long you could serve, so nobody else deigned to do it either until Franklin Roosevelt came around. Maybe the best pure politician we've ever had as president. And he had that ability. And, you know, when you look at the guys who have it, they're not always the most savory characters. I mean, Lyndon Johnson comes to mind. People who know how to get things done in the American system. And, you know, Bismarck famously said, if you don't like watching, you know, how they make sausage, don't watch how they make policy either. I mean, it's not a pretty thing to watch what goes on behind the scenes. And Lyndon Johnson almost got physical with you sometimes. Roosevelt, it's hard to explain how he did what he did. Now, at the time, he also had a Congress that was pretty reliably Democratic most of the time, maybe all the time. So he could line up the votes for these big changes that he wanted to make, things like the New Deal. But you run into a bottleneck if you really want to make transformative change in the American system. What is it? It's the Supreme Court. That's why Roosevelt focused on it so much. He was accused of trying to pack the court once. You know, expand the number of members from the current number to more, and then he would get the, you know, opportunity to put the more on there, thereby sort of changing the nature of the court in terms of how it saw what was and what wasn't constitutional, which is, of course, the role of the court. I have some friends who will date the beginning of the current problems with the Supreme Court to that era, the era where, you know, somebody looked and said, aha, if you want to make major changes in the American system, you have to get it through the Supreme Court. If you have the power to put people on the Supreme Court, and as president you nominate them, right? Why wouldn't you pick somebody who saw things in a way that made it more likely for you to be able to do what it was you were trying to do on behalf of everybody and the good of all, of course? You would, right? So that's how that develops. Other people will suggest, and I always think this is a safe bet, if you bet this way, you win 80% of the time at historical Vegas, that it's always been that way. Go back to the John Adams administration and we're having issues with Supreme Court versus presidential power and, you know, seeing the Constitution certain ways. And my goodness, one of our early presidents, Andrew Jackson, if he'd been armed in the presence of some of these Supreme Court members at one time or another, there might have been a couple of judicial killings. He had real problems with the Supreme Court. So that goes pretty much all the way back to the beginning. And it's something that if you think about the way the system is set up, it's not surprising. I've often thought that in the U.S. system that we have a dynamic that those of you, for example, you know, who could look back on European history in the Middle Ages would recognize, you know, who was it who could contest the power and authority of a king or an emperor in Middle Ages Europe? There was really only one other power source, right? The church. And so in multiple countries, you have these, you know, sometimes centuries long back and forths, sometimes hot, sometimes cold, you know, wars, if you will, with the church. I mean, German emperors from the Holy Roman Empire famously, were having problems with the Pope. Thomas a Becket's death in England. I mean, it's just over and over and over again. Those are the only source out there that really has any potential check on the executive. In our system, that's the Supreme Court. Now, you would think it would be Congress. Remember, we have a system in this country that's a triad system. Executive branch, the president. Legislative branch, the Congress. Judicial branch, the Supreme Court, and all the courts below it. It's like a three-headed monster. Everybody watching out and providing an extra layer of protection for everyone else. So we've been telling you for a long time in this program about the problem we're having in a system with corruption. And it would be naive to think that the corruption only impacts the executive and legislative branches and that the judicial branch is immune. Even in a position where the occupants to the highest bench in the land serve until they die. That's what happened since the last show we did. One of them did. Justice Antonin Scalia was found dead at a resort. It's assumed natural causes. And it shouldn't be that surprising because the Supreme Court is the one, you know, agency in our government here where the people serve for life. It's a very interesting sort of twist to an office in a, you know, Republican system, isn't it? Lifetime tenure. The funny thing about it is it almost harkens back to, like, you can see the antecedents from the Greek and the Roman times and the idea of these people that could just, you know, through their august nature, simply stay there even into the geriatric age, you know. It does have some very interesting sort of ramifications, and I think Scalia is a perfect example of that. You know, if you think about it this way, Justice Scalia, who was a Reagan appointee, is really the last fumes of that administration finally, you know, wafting away. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there who like Ronald Reagan, and so they would think that having Justice Scalia last as long as he did and be able to impact the court with, you know, an injection of the attitudes from the time when he was picked for high office, you know, into our modern debate here is a good thing. But of course, you have to imagine the shoe on the other foot, don't you? If you're going to be very happy to see President Obama, for example, end his term in office, how do you feel about people on the court maybe 30 years from now where you're still sniffing the fumes from this era? How's it feel, right? That's the problem. Once upon a time, maybe people would think that that was one of the benefits of having lifetime service on the court. I think now it's one of the downsides. In a world that changes at the speed ours does, I don't think having people, you know, who aren't using email is a smart group of people to be making the ultimate decisions on things like encryption. Call me crazy. And listen, I say this, by the way, you know, I had read, it makes me think, you know, I'm getting older now, folks. You think about different things. I turned 50 recently, and I can't get my mind around, peaking in certain ways. I think athletes get these things at younger ages, right? If you're used to being the fastest person on the field, you know, by the time you turn 28, 29, it doesn't matter how gifted as an athlete you were, younger guys who are gifted are beating you. Maybe people who couldn't carry your jock strap back in the day are beating you. And you have to adjust to that a little bit. I'm not as good as I once was in this area. Sometimes I feel like that too. I'm not as quick as I used to be, and I'm not as sharp as I used to be. I think I compensate for that. I've read more books now, right? I've got more life experience. And so, you know, just like that veteran on the football field, you know, to use another sports analogy, I've lost a step, but I'm more experienced on how I bump that receiver off the line. You know, I make up for it with technique. We can cover with technique only for so long. I was reading my Will Durant books the other night. They're fun before bedtime. Take you to another place. And he was writing the intro for the last book that he completed. And he's a very old man by that time. And he said something to the effect of, as much as we like to pretend that as we get older, we really don't lose anything in terms of our ability to think, you know, logically and well and in an inspirational fashion might be a good way to put it too. He says, that's a lie. And he goes, you know, he can see it in the writing. And I only mention my own personal failings because I think about those people on the court serving their lifetime terms and how far past their prime they are, even if they're a lot, you know, more supple and pliant and, you know, stretchable than I am. I will allow for the fact that I might be weak, but no matter how strong you are, no matter how good of an athlete you are, when you're 30, there's some 24-year-old who could outrun you, right? And if you're not really able to use things like email 20 years after the entire world started using email, that might be a sign that you may no longer be in touch enough to be making proper decisions. Now, this is obviously not just a problem for the court. I mean, famously, there was the incident with George Bush the Elder, Herbert Walker Bush, when he was running against Bill Clinton in 91, 92, and they took him out of the White House, and they wanted to show him, you know, just he's regular folks, right? And they take him to a grocery store, and he makes a big deal over the scanner that you run the groceries over, and it scans the price code and rings it up. And he made a big deal out of that, and it backfired on him because that had been in the stores for a long time. The fact that he didn't know that showed how out of touch he was, right? And sometimes, by the way, I read things that make me think that even some of the younger justices are out of touch, but I can't tell what I'm really reading. I mean, for example, you know, over the last couple of weeks, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, has been going around giving interviews and speaking to the media, and one of the themes he's continually emphasizing, which makes me think it's the point he wants to get out, is that he's worried people are starting to think that the court is political, as opposed to an unbiased, deliberative body, you know, looking at everything on the merits, da-da-da. And the first thing you think to yourself, if you are a keen observer of U.S. politics, is either that John Roberts is as out of touch as George Bush was with the scanner, or the Supreme Court justices who don't use email or anything like that, if he really thinks that. Of course, the other possibility is he's very aware of the whole thing, and, you know, we just don't talk about those guys. Marketing, you know, I mean, this is the Supreme Court is the body that is most insulated from the politics of the day, because after all, none of us are running for re-election. None of us are taking money, you see? And I will say that that has insulated the court for a very long time, I think. At the same time, you have to look at why the people who have their jobs on the court have them. And the truth is, I think you could make a case that not a single one of them is up there if they didn't have two things that you need to be a Supreme Court justice these days, neither one of which really has to do with how good you do your job. The first is, you have to see constitutional law the way the people that would be putting you through the nomination want you to see it. You know, the president who nominates you for the court is going to want you to see things the way he sees them constitutionally. The other thing you have to be is confirmable. Everybody who's on the court now is on there because they saw the Constitution the way the president who nominated them wanted it seen, and because they had whatever qualities were necessary at the time, given the climate in place then, to be confirmable, to get through Congress. So to suggest that people on the court are not political is to ignore why they were picked in the first place. It reminds me, by the way, very much of what the Congress people and whatnot who take money from outside firms, for example, let's just say a firm that handles batteries, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're writing tax breaks for battery firms into a little loophole legislation, and when somebody catches you on it, you turn around and go, now, wait a minute, I understand this looks bad, but I've always been for battery loopholes, and it just so happens the battery companies out there realize that they and I think the same way on these things, and so they support me, but I was always this way. The guys on the court who are conservative, or the people on the court who are liberal, may very well argue that nothing that has been done has changed them, but they were picked specifically for who they were already. They didn't have to change. They got the job because they are who they are. And it's not that they are the most, you know, august justices in the land who've proven brilliance across the board. There's the people who saw the Constitution the way Franklin Roosevelt wanted it seen when he wanted to pass the New Deal, right? Do you believe the New Deal's constitutional? No, sorry, see you later. Do you believe the New Deal's constitutional? Yes, we'll see you on the high court, young man. So you end up with people on the court that are there for ideological reasons, whether or not they themselves are ideological. So I tend to believe Roberts is intelligent enough to see that, in which case, he's pulling the wool over our eyes. You darn well know it's ideological, otherwise people wouldn't be able to figure out how the court's reliably going to vote, you know, on this or that issue almost all the time. The people that make you think they're thinking about this stuff are the people who are the swing votes, right? If somebody doesn't reliably come down one way or the other, they might be considering the merits of everything. If I can say that on gun control, Justice Scalia is going to go this way, and Justice Sotomayor is going to go that way, well, you know, how much thinking's really going on? And you may say, well, they've thought for years, Dan. They're august justices who wrote heavily on these subjects before they were even nominated to the court. Exactly, which is why they were nominated to the court. when President Obama nominates a anti-abortion, pro-Second Amendment, you know, candidate to the Supreme Court, you'll see me wrong. But he's not going to do that. He's going to focus on the two things that you need to do to replace Justice Scalia. Get somebody in there who backs up the way that his side wants the constitutional, you know, framework interpreted, and somebody that's hard for the Congress to not vote for. Now, speaking of Scalia specifically, I'm going to miss him in the sense that he was the most fun of the justices for people like me to read their decisions and their rationales and their dissents and whatnot. You know, so many of the justices have a very boring is probably not the wrong word, way of describing things. And let's be honest, folks, don't kid yourself. I mean, a lot of this stuff is written by like 26-year-old legal clerks, right? I mean, I read somewhere that all of these justices are in effect an opinion-writing little mini firm that work under each one of them. So, I mean, let's understand who's really writing this stuff, and it's a little bit scary. Nonetheless, you got the feeling with Scalia's stuff that it might have been his own hand, and he might have really enjoyed doing that. There was actually emotion, you know, in some of his stuff, and humor, and I mean, there were a lot of things in there you just didn't encounter normally. And what I liked about it is oftentimes the sheer openness of the way he spoke about things made you, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of us who get really tired of obfuscation, and it's everywhere in politics, and let's be honest, the Supreme Court's political too. So it's always somewhat refreshing, and I think that's why some people like Trump. I think it's refreshing to hear people who are at least speaking less BS than, you know, what we're accustomed to hearing, and I think you got that from Scalia. He called himself a textualist, or sometimes he's lumped in with people who call themselves originalists. And for those of you who don't know, or people from outside the country, originalists are sort of a reaction to people out there who think of an evolving constitution. A living document, it's sometimes called by those kinds of folks. And those are people who believe, you know, and then they've got a case in one sense that the Constitution is loosely written to allow evolution, right? If you lined up every single rule and regulation instead of a broad constitution, well, how much of that stuff gets outdated very quickly? If you are a little bit more amorphous in the rules and enunciate rather broad principles or big laws as opposed to little ones, there's more room to adapt as conditions change. The problem is that for a lot of lawyers, which is, let's be honest, what we're talking about here, that's a lot of room for loopholes over the eras. And so you can look at something, let's say, like the Commerce Clause, and you can say, well, Congress can do this, whatever this might be. You could just lump it in under a power that's given to them under the Commerce Clause, right? There's commerce involved, right? Any dollars here? Okay, well, you see, there you go. You do that enough, and then what's the point of having rules at all, right? And that's what a guy like Scalia comes in and wants to suggest something like, well, that's not what those people who wrote that intended. This, of course, opens up all kinds of different cans of worms, right? Trying to figure out what those people intended, you know, what their concept of a militia was maybe in the 18th century versus how we would think of it now. I mean, it's fraught with almost as many pitfalls sometimes as the other method, especially when it's not applied, you know, consistently, which none of these people seem to do. You know, let me just take a little detour here, because one of the problems with the court has always been, and it's a difficult thing for people in the legal realm to deal with, because there really is no alternative way it's been done. What do you do if you're a court and you rely, as courts do, on legal precedent, right? The decision of earlier courts. What do you do if so many of those decisions are horrifying or just plain bad? Do you cherry pick and you say, well, we're going to ignore that one right now because it doesn't work really well. We'll use that one. I mean, in other words, when you've acquired enough of a body of law that you can cherry pick certain things and leave other things behind, when does that become a bit of a shell game, right? When you look at all the terrible court decisions in the past, you want to throw out the idea of using precedent at all, don't you? My own personal beef with the courts, and you might as well be aware of them, it's only fair, right, if I sort of assign my own biases out in front, is that, you know, when I was a kid, and so much of who we are and how we see things, I think, is maybe imprinted on us early on. Is that an obvious thing to say? Probably an obvious thing to say. But in my case, I have an image of this country, and it was the things that, when I was a kid, they pounded into you. And one of the things we used to get all the Supreme Court decisions, which were things that took the idea of America and made it more like it was supposed to be, mythologically speaking. There were a lot of courts when I was growing up that were finding more protections for individuals, protections from the government, protections from this, that, and the other thing. And those for a guy who really thinks that this country is mostly about individual freedom and the right to live your life the way you see fit, that's a court that in my mind is acting as a defender of me, protecting me, playing a watchdog role in the system, which is, of course, what it's supposed to do, right? But in the last 20, really 30 years, the court hasn't done a lot of that, and increasingly less. And more of it in the modern times has been on the complete opposite of what I grew up with sort of liking about the court. It's the stuff that destroys the Fourth Amendment. It's the rulings that we talk about all the time that go so in favor of, you know, the government at the expense of individuals, often because we have a war on terror. I mean, a real Supreme Court, in my mind, a long time ago, would have figured out a case they could have taken and examined that talked about the amount of government secrecy we have going on right now. When you talk about a watchdog, that's the kind of things that sometimes, you know, for lots of reasons you can't imagine elected legislators doing, which is one of the good arguments for why you have a court that isn't elected. You know, I remember somebody once explaining to me that one of the ideas behind having a court where the members serve for life is that they are insulated from the political storms of individual eras, right? So let's say you have a second Red Scare with Senator Joseph McCarthy and a communist behind every bush, and that's a huge issue if you're an elected official, and people who had to get votes had to bend with the times and, you know, respond to charges of this, and that the Supreme Court could stay aloof and above all of that, right? Those people serve for so long that an era like that is a third or a fourth of the time on the average, you know, service on the court, right? So a blip for them in terms of what they have to go through, and there's nobody that's going to throw them off, there's no votes they have to worry about, and there's nobody that can tell them what to do. But see, being protected from the firestorms of the moment does not insulate them from being products of whatever the political firestorms were at the time they were nominated and confirmed. Justice Scalia is a perfect example to me. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, the Reagan administration was able to take its ideas and inject them into a future where most of the people I would think who were in the Reagan administration in prominent positions aren't even around to see anymore. I'm not sure that's a good thing, especially, like I said, in terms of an ever-changing, you know, world. Now, it insulates them from the, you know, firestorms of the moment, right? This whole internet fad isn't affecting them much, right? They're able to be aloof over that. At the same time, it doesn't mean that they weren't products of an era where certainly, because we always are, we were preoccupied with some other firestorm, and then they bring that firestorm and the controversies surrounding that into our future 30 years later before, you know, passing away. I will miss his ferocious and sometimes funny and easy to understand, for the most part, dissents. I'd like to see more justices who wrote like that. Now, he's gone. The problem of one of the most valuable political seats that come up in the United States system is in front of us. Let's talk about that for just a minute. The fact that the court has such an impact on, you know, whether or not things actually can get done, and because they are, for all intents and purposes, you know, the last voice, right? The people that if they say no, good luck getting it past them. You can always maybe write an amendment to the Constitution, but there's a reason those things are few and far between. So for the most part, when a Supreme Court seat opens up, you're putting someone in office that's going to be there on average 20, 30 years. So it's a huge deal. And they're going to have a 1/9 say in the most important issues of our time and the things that, you know, most impact a president's ability to get something done the way they want. I mean, there's a reason they're not just putting the best person on the job, right? There's a reason there are interviews. There's a reason there's a confirmation process. And there's a reason that the kind of questions they're going to ask at the confirmation process are things like, What is your opinion on Roe versus Wade? I mean, if it's not political, why are we asking any of this stuff? Because if you answer that question wrong, you don't get the job. So the people who eventually get the job are not the best justices. They're the people that didn't answer questions like that from the left and the right wrong. That's also how corruption impacts who gets picked for the Supreme Court. The justices themselves may not take money, but they're getting the job based on the priorities of someone who's determining those priorities, often based on who's giving him money and what for. You know, you may argue, for example, that the things I just said about the court not defending individual rights is incorrect because, Dan, listen, the Supreme Court justices I've liked on the court have defended my Second Amendment rights. Well, you might say the Supreme Court justices that I've liked on the court have defended my, you know, reproductive rights. Yes, but those are both heavily funded interests. We have a lot of our most important rights that aren't really defended by much money at all. Fourth Amendment, for example, is a perfect one. And even though these justices may see things, you know, totally from a legal point of view, totally unbiased, not taking any money, uncorrupt to the core, the people that are deciding whether or not they like those justices based on the questions they ask are anything but. And their priorities determine who ends up on the court. So whose priorities really determined who ended up on the court? Maybe the people that gave the original money to the legislators who had to decide to confirm or not to confirm in the first place. You know, the old line about why you really can't stop money in politics with campaign finance reform of the sort we've had in the past is because money's like water. It just finds a way, you know, to its destination. And even though the court itself is somewhat insulated to the direct, you know, flow of corruption from the rest of the system, it's like water and it finds a way indirectly to impact it anyway. We'd be fools to kid ourselves that that wasn't the case. Already you see the BS meter skyrocketing on all sides, with the president and the Democrats saying it would be some sort of a criminal offense practically for the Republicans to not let him, you know, with so many months left in office, nominate, you know, and get confirmed the next justice to replace Scalia, and the Republicans basically, you know, saying similar things on their side. And folks, the reason this is all BS is because if you flipped the president's party label and this entire thing was just the opposite of what it is, everyone would be doing what the other side is doing. Oh, exactly. Exactly. The hypocrisy level to do it anyway when everybody knows the other side would react exactly the same drives me crazy, right? Could you at least acknowledge that we are smart enough to know that if this were George W. Bush doing this, and this was going to be another Scalia to replace the last Scalia, that you wouldn't be delaying every step of the way? Of course you would, and your supporters would expect you to. You can't let another blah, 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 okay? That's how it would be. American politics, maybe politics anywhere. Here's the problem I have. If you look at my biases that I laid out earlier, the idea that, you know, the protection in terms of individual rights is such a low priority for our legislators now. And you think about the court when I was a kid doing so much to sort of take up those issues. We could argue whether or not what they did was good or bad. Or, I mean, but the idea that that was an important thing for them to champion was important to me. Now, do you think anybody that got up there and said in the interview process, Mr. President, I think executive authority has gone too far in this country. I think there's too much secrecy. And I do think that Americans are being spied on too much. Goodbye. So you're not going to make it on the court if you think the way, you know, I think a justice has to look to reform our country and take it back to a place where we're more like we're supposed to be in all the myths. How about that? Does that make sense? To fix the problems I see, we need court justices that see that as a priority, and they will never make it through the nominating or confirmation process if they think the way I want them to think. It's also partly the reason, folks, why, you know, you're not going to get Supreme Court justices probably ruling on campaign finance questions the way we want either. Because the people who are nominating these justices, regardless of what they say, are more interested in crippling the fundraising opportunities of their partisan opponents than they are fixing the system as a whole, right? The plans that they like are the ones that will hurt the other party. The plans they don't like are the ones that would hamstring all the parties. So you're not going to nominate a person who thinks too outside the box on that either. You see what I'm saying? This is where the nomination process and the confirmation process end up making sure that we get people who are on there because they see the Constitution a specific way. And over time, that warps everything. So when Justice Roberts says we're seeing the court as political, or he's worried about that, I would suggest that, you know, the minute he starts surprising me with major votes, I'll change my mind. Now, the other topic I wanted to get into today, actually, if you wanted to, you could make a pretty darn easy tie-in between this one and the one we just discussed about the Supreme Court, because it's possible this may find itself in front of the court at some point. It has to do with this standoff between Apple and, you know, I'll say the government right now, because I think it's officially the government, but certainly it's with the FBI specifically, over the FBI's request that Apple help them break into a phone that was involved in the San Bernardino terrorist attacks of a while ago. And I have all these stories here, and I thought, okay, I'll quote this one, and I thought, no, you know, when you're as late as you are getting on a show, everybody knows most of this background stuff. I would think about the Apple thing, basically. I mean, the basic story's pretty freaking fascinating all by itself, but the angles, you know, that you see here are very fun to ponder. The basics for those who maybe don't know is the government wants, in this particular case, Apple to build a code, it looks like, that lets them break into the phone. Because right now, the phone, because Apple does it this way, you know, if you try 10 times to put in a code and you don't get it right 10 times, it can erase the data if it's set up to do that. And a while back, and you know, folks, I'm not a computer expert, but I find some of this stuff absolutely wild. I mean, the idea that Apple had, which is sort of at the root of all this, to make the phones essentially Apple-proof, right? That they designed the phones, some of these stories were great at explaining, they designed these phones, and maybe for the first time a company like them ever had to try to do that, to make it so they themselves couldn't get into it. And that this is kind of a response to the whole, you know, telecommunications cooperation with the government after 9/11 that came to light. Once again, maybe those Edward Snowden things paying a dividend, because that's how we found out a lot about this stuff. And when that came, you know, out, it became a primary interest for companies to be able to tell people, no, we're not doing giving your stuff to the government. No. And people would say, well, how do we know? You've done it before and you kept it a secret. How would we know you're not doing it now? How could you get out of that? How could you assure an audience, listen, you can be sure that your stuff is safe if you use our product? Well, you make a product that you yourself couldn't break into if the government asked you to. And that's apparently what Apple did. In addition, this gets you out of a whole lot of problems overseas, too. If you go to a place that's a repressive regime, and maybe they don't like the idea that there's no, you know, way for them to get into your phone, you just basically say, well, that's how they're designed. I mean, that's how it is in every country of the world. You know, we can't make it for you. China, we can't build you the special break-intoable Apple phone. Sorry, we just, they're all the same. We build them from, like, the firmware up. It's integral to the product as a whole. Sorry, nothing we can do about it. And so the government came out early on in this little standoff with one of these lines that just makes you laugh. The line was something to the effect of, we just want it this one time. Just give it, just make us this special code that will allow us to keep making attempts to break into this until we break into it, and we just need it for this one thing. Now, you know, folks, sometimes you run out of words. The problem that we have when we discuss the government in any of these intelligence matters is you just can't believe them. You just can't. I mean, and the problem I have sometimes arguing people is that you'll argue with people and they'll you'll say something like that and they'll say, well, your credibility is shot. That if you're not going to believe anything the government says, well, when it comes to intelligence, I mean, you want to hold your hands out and say, I mean, Dianne Feinstein was lied to, and she's the most pro-intelligence senator sitting on the Intelligence Senate Committee. I mean, they lie about everything. That's just how it is, okay? And you know what? They may be able to say in private that that's defending a whole bunch of things, Dan Carlin, that you will be damn happy we kept from you if you knew what they were and how bad they are. I acknowledge that. But let's, there's no reason for Apple to think that it's going to just be that one time. And that's what they basically said.
It is not going to be the one time. The minute you use it once, you're going to have something terrible the next day. And then the next day after that, and then, you know, where are we now?
Folks, that's not a slippery slope,
disaster theory, Dan, that'll never come true.
That's the way things go.
And all historical evidence lines up to confirm that.
So Apple says, no, if we do it once, we're going to have to do it 1,000 times for you. And then how many times do you think China is going to ask us to do it for them, right? That opens up a can of worms. So they're making this stand, and they're saying no. And there's multiple, I mean, I don't know where to start on how interesting all of this is. Let's start with one of the motives, because the motives here are not clear and nobody's being completely honest. Apple is not calling this a sales move. They're portraying this as a high-minded, stand for freedom, in a sense. What was it Tim Cook said in a stock meeting or said in a letter to stockholders? If you don't like that, if you're just in this to make money, this is not the stock for you or something. Well, the funny thing about that is that's sort of an anti-marketing move, marketing coup, isn't it? I mean, in an era of anti-establishmentism, maybe Tim Cook and Apple have sensed the mood, right? Trump, Sanders, Cook. Fighting the establishment, right? Fighting the man. Well, folks, we had talked in previous shows about how maybe the state in this post 9/11 world especially has become so powerful that the only thing that really rivals it, the only thing that really can decide anything other than what the state wants is the corporate power. This is one of the great big companies deciding to, go toe-to-toe with the U.S. government over something. And most of the time, I would instantly bet on the company because the U.S. government generally doesn't want these fights, right? Generally doesn't want them. But when national security is the issue, that's the one thing that sort of, you can throw out the record books with that one because that's something they may go toe-to-toe over. I've heard some talk on the government side about this going to the Supreme Court, which Apple doesn't want. I read a story today that says Apple hopes to do this in Congress, and why wouldn't they? They've given a ton of money to Congress. Once again, this is how corruption plays into everything. I mean, Apple gives money to this congressman. If the question of whether or not Apple can be required to jailbreak phones for the government comes in front of this congressman that Apple gave $200,000 to or whatever, how do you think they vote? What I love about that, too, is Apple then puts all this campaign cash corruption stuff to work to perhaps protect individual rights. Apple's there protecting our individual rights. I don't believe a word Tim Cook says about this, high-mindedness, but for their own corporate benefit. In other words, Apple's needs have dovetailed with our needs on some of these things because the free market wants privacy. We have a government, by the way, likes to talk about the free market a lot. The free market wants privacy. The FBI officials and some of these people who've come out and said, nasty things about what will happen if Apple doesn't allow the phones to be, accessed by the government, say things like, well, the pedophiles will do this and the burglars will do that. Well, those people aren't going to keep Apple afloat. It's a lot of other people, the rest of the world, that would like the privacy. And yes, the bad guys will get to benefit from that too, but so will all the good people. The problem here is that we still have a mentality from an era where the government required the ability to break into communications and listen in when really there were very few competitors, for doing that but the government. If they wanted the right to listen in on your phone conversations, well, it wasn't like the neighbor down the street would then listen in on your phone conversations. That was a power granted to the government. But if what the government needs to, for example, break into an iPhone will create a security flaw that other people can then break into an iPhone, what they're essentially saying is, we have the right to hack into your system, even if that makes it possible for everyone else to hack into your system. And yes, in the 1970s, when we used to listen in on your phone conversations, there weren't any other hackers, but we're going to continue to look at this the same way we did back then. In the interest of national security, you can't have individual security. But you know what, folks? At what point does mass individual insecurity become a collective national security threat? I mean, if we ended up in an era someday, ladies and gentlemen, You know, we'll use the word Orwellian while we recognize that it would never be as Orwell described it. It's going to be a different kind of reality, but it may have a lot of the elements of a completely transparent everything you do, watched by everybody all the time. If we end up in something like that, wouldn't you say that that was a terrible crisis to have been avoided? Is anybody looking forward to an era like that? Where there is absolutely no privacy and no protections at all? I don't think you are. I don't think anybody is. I think we'd like to avoid that. How do you avoid that? When do you get to vote on, I don't want to end up living in a dystopia someday? You never get to vote on that. You never get to weigh in on that. You never have too many of the pundits of the day arguing that question. Instead, you have them arguing things like, should Apple be forced to make it possible for the government to break into iPhones? And you could make, as the public, as the legislators, even as the Supreme Court, the right decision on every single one of these individual questions, like breaking into the iPhone. Of course they have to be able to break into the iPhone. Precedent says since 1970, blah, 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 they've been breaking into phones, and this is the same thing. You could make the right decision every step of the way and end up in that dystopian destination because you did. The right short-term answer to these security problems can end up creating a world that any of us would have given anything to avoid ending up in, and it happened in a completely understandable way every step of the way. I mean, how many times do you see that in history, too, where everybody does exactly what you would expect them to do, and because they did, you know, they ended up in a terrible historical trend, shall we say. But to me, that's a security question, too, a national security question, and I weigh that when people say this will make it more likely we will be attacked by terrorists. I always say, how much closer does something like this get us to that long-term outcome we don't want to live in? When it comes to the specifics of the Apple case, I have to say, I favor Apple in this case, and I favor their position, and I would, right? You know my biases. I think what the government is seeing is public opinion speaking through purchasing habits that says that people do not want to be, you know, living in a dystopian world where everything on their phone is vulnerable, whether it's to the government or to hackers. Again, something that you know, when the Supreme Court looks at something like this, they're going to look at precedent and they're going to look at, you know, decisions against AT&T in 1971, Bell Telephone, blah, blah, and they're not apples and apples. As we said, giving the government the right to listen in on your phone conversations in 1970s New York is not the same as creating a hole that everybody in the world with certain capabilities is capable of exploiting. And listening in on your phone conversations probably isn't going to give those same hackers all of the most important stuff about you that can make your life a living hell for years to come. Ask anybody who's had a really bad identity theft story. People want individual protection and privacy, and what the government is saying is if you do that, it is a threat to national security. To me, that's a watershed moment there. Who wins in this conversation? Now, what's likely to happen, if you go to Vegas, where's the money going? This is an issue where you're likely to get both sides compromising and then skulking away, claiming some sort of victory. I do love the fact that we could be watching corruption working for the civil liberties cause here, as Apple tries to argue for, you know, individual protection. And I do think it's genius to have done it the way they did it, because the only way the public was ever going to believe a corporate giant now, when they said, no, really, we're not funneling all your information to anybody with a court order behind the scenes without telling you, was to make the phones incapable of doing that, right? I know you won't believe me, so we made the phones of a sort so you don't have to trust me. You'll just know. So when we consider what might happen here, I'd like to consider outcomes because, of course, you know, the FBI and people like that and people on that side will talk about the lives that will be lost, the pedophiles in you know, fleeing with children that will not be captured, all these things. And I believe all of them. I believe all of them. But that's the stuff that will result from the wrong decision on this Apple, you know, phone breakage question. But what happens if Apple wins this, uses their millions of dollars that they give to Congress to get Congress to vote that they don't have to do this because it's a free market question. Consumers can decide, right? Or something like that. Put a warning label. And 3 years later, the sky hasn't fallen. What if Apple does this and basically everything's still okay? Maybe that's the most dangerous thing that could happen here, really, to the people that want to keep us worried about security so much that on a question like this, we should just reflexively say, of course they have to be able to listen in on phone conversations. The terrorists will get us. Maybe they will. But what if they don't? Might be interesting to see if we pulled back from the edge of wherever we are right now, if things might still be okay. And if they were, maybe we could pull back a little bit more. There's a lot of people, by the way, who don't want to do that. A lot of money invested on not pulling back from where we are, but pushing forward to the next level of security, whatever that might be. But maybe we could live in a less secure world. I know that runs counter to modern thought, doesn't it? But I don't know about you, but the more secure we make the world, the more it starts to become like a destination that might be, you know, a safe place to live, but not a very good place to live. What did Eisenhower say all those years ago? You know, if you want complete security, you can go to jail. But when you think about it, this is really indicative of what a really effective tool terrorism is. I mean, terror is the root word, right? It takes advantage of human qualities. I mean, these aren't American qualities when we talk about people's willingness to vote, you know, for something that will make them safer. That's human beings from time immemorial, right? So it hits at something that was probably a self-protective measure going back to, like, you know, original times. Hitting us someplace that's probably an evolutionary, you know, self-protective measure, right? Danger, boom, protect me. Who wouldn't think of that? The problem is that if you're operating essentially, you know, on a voter-based system, that's something you can really take advantage of. That's like being able to take advantage of other, you know, basic human needs. I mean, hunger. They're starving. Lots of food? Yes, vote for me. Terrorism, danger, protect me. I will. Just let me put a couple of Supreme Court justices on that think about the Constitution a little bit more like I do, and I can get that done for you. In the history show right now, and maybe consider this an official tease, you know, Herodotus is looking at the question, and I love the ancient perspective, you know, of sort of the pros and cons, maybe you could call it, of democracy versus monarchy. And in the tale, he has a kind of a salesman-like guy trying to get Greeks involved in his own personal quarrel. And he goes to Sparta, and he meets with one of their two kings, who essentially gives him an audience, right? Like a Shark Tank thing. And the Spartan king spots the flaw in this guy, sees through him, right? And tells him to go away. So the guy goes to Athens, which is a democracy at the time, and where instead of, you know, pitching the single king, he pitches public opinion, right? He gives speeches in front of people and wins them over. And Herodotus says something to the effect it was easier to sway 30,000 Athenians than it was one Spartan king. And when you're talking about things that are as reliably knee-jerk as security, protect me, that's something that can be really exploited by people who want to take the country in one direction or another. Maybe just because it's a profitable question. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons people might want more security and might be able to exploit your fears to get it. And the dynamic is also wonderful because at the same time it promotes a need for more security, it sort of argues against anybody trying to make the case that there might be a downside to that someday. And if you're talking about, listen, if we can make the right decision on all these individual questions and screw ourselves in the end, nobody's going to want to hear that after the next terror attack. I mean, one of the best stories I saw about this, someone shared with me on Twitter, and you can follow us, by the way, at DC Common Sense. But it essentially took the very Dan Carlin-like take on the subject, which is, you know, don't kid yourselves. What do you think's going to happen with Apple and this phone thing after the next 9/11 attack happens? Getting down to brass tacks, I would say, on the question right there, wouldn't you? It's a nice face-off, but at the same time, you know, after the next terror attack, when you have images on the TV and then you'll get some legislators up there looking to make hay, who'll say, you know, will Tim Cook and Apple stand up here now and say we shouldn't be able to get into their phones? I mean, how do you resist that? If you're up there protecting your right to privacy, what do you have that can balance out that kind of nastiness that hits us someplace in our DNA, right? Protect me.
Well, I might have to take some freedoms from you. I might have to open up your phone to
I don't care. Just my kids. Which, by the way, is how I feel, too. So that's how you know how human it is. And it makes me think, you know, with this Herodotus thing, he was talking about the Spartan king and all that and how he was able to resist and see more the big picture that maybe a public opinion thing wouldn't, you know, the public being more prone to a little knee-jerkedness. Makes me think of, like, Eisenhower. I've been reading some books on Eisenhower lately that remind me, shall we say, although the modern Eisenhower books are somewhat different than earlier ones, but he's an interesting character, and you miss a guy like that now. He was a very good balancer, much better than we had known at the time. Well, not that I was there, but when I was growing up, there wasn't the appreciation for Eisenhower that we have now because the Cold War looks different to us now, and you can see, you know, exactly what was working on a guy like Eisenhower, that he was able to resist to give us the results that we've always known about and give some context to those results, right? So you kind of go, okay, so when Eisenhower did this, I shouldn't interpret that on a neutral scale. I should realize that, oh my gosh, you know, the people around him were trying to go twice as far, right? And Eisenhower dialed that back because he was a general. He was able to resist the military when they would ask for too much or get too optimistic about the outcome of potential operations. He certainly had a great understanding of opportunity costs when it came to things like defense spending. He was tough as he needed to be, but he wasn't somebody who was going to see the country he grew up in. And remember, he's a Midwesterner, grew up with all the American Norman Rockwell myths intact, and was not going to do anything in his mind to mess that up too much if he could help it. And those are wonderful attributes, I think, to balance out, you know, the needs of the moment. And the needs of the moment often take you farther and farther away from that Norman Rockwell existence. And you may say something like, well, Dan, there's a reason that that's a romanticized era in the past. It's a long time ago. Things have changed. Exactly. How much can you hold on to the things in this country that make it what it is and that we celebrate in reality, as opposed to just simply saluting a bunch of marketing slogans? Those sorts of ideals are in combat with the things we may need to protect ourselves and other things. Like I said, I mean, in the interest of national security, our government is essentially telling us that we cannot have individual security. How important is collective individual security? Is that more likely to cause Americans more grief than some lack of a hole in an unbreak-intoable Apple phone? You know, what's going to end up being worse in the long run? And again, are human beings capable of really thinking like that? Or are we predictable enough to just know, listen, after the next terror attack, it doesn't matter. We'll do anything. And if that's the case, well, then I think it's inevitable that the road we're on is going to be, you know, what we go down, because a halt to terrorist attacks is not going to happen. People's desire for security, and that being a winning campaign issue, is not going to change either. It's hard to see this dynamic changing, except when you throw in unusual wild cards like the idea that the needs of some of these very powerful corporations that give a lot of money to the legislators of countries like the United States begin to dovetail, you know, with the public's, in part because the public are the ones they're trying to appeal to. The government might not be all that responsive these days to the average Joe and Jane, but Apple wants to sell them stuff. So all of a sudden, in their own interests, Apple may be defending the interests of personal privacy. Our job is to be able to continue to understand the wisdom of that in general. The next time something happens and the government says, well, that could have been prevented if we could have just gotten into that guy's phone. Those who would trade essential liberty for temporary security deserve neither liberty nor security. It's a pretty wise statement, isn't it? Because in order to live up to it, you have to be able to resist evolutionary reactions. People will say, what if it's your child? That's the key line, right? What if it's your child? I've said before, if it's my child, we're all in trouble. We go straight to Nazism, and I go door-to-door searching for her. Is that the country you want to live in, though? The problem with security, folks, as Eisenhower said, is how do you go about defending from without while not destroying what you're trying to protect within? That's a misquote, but you get the gist. That's pretty wise. And that's actually something that might be easier to do in a country where one person made all the decisions like a Spartan king than in one where the will of the people is what rules and the people are governed by, you know, the evolutionary responses. Isn't that weird that the only way to maintain individual freedom in a case like that might be by having somebody who was a, you know, by modern standards, total dictator, a freedom dictator? No, I shall not let you give up your rights. You'll regret it in the long haul. Go back, sit down. Dad has spoken.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. It's about the cost of a soft drink, and yet it's so much more stimulating. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.